Part 2 of 4, delivered June 8, 2012, from the series Four Great Essays of C.G. Jung, a bcrecordings.net copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Psychology of the Spirit, delivered as a lecture at one of the Aranos conferences. This essay is a seminal work on the deeper aspects of Jung's psychology.
And with that, I think we'll proceed to this evening's discussion, which is dealing primarily with an essay entitled The Psychology of the Spirit. This was Jung's lecture, which he delivered at one of the famous Eranos meetings in Ascona, in the Italian part of Switzerland, and this one he delivered in 1945. And it was published first in the German language in the Eranos Jahrbuch of 1945 under the title Zur Psychologie des Geistes, and in the first English translation was published in the first volume of the Eranos Yearbook under the heading Spirit and Nature, which was edited along with all the other English translations of the Eranos Yearbooks by a young and very active Joseph Campbell. This was one of Campbell's early great works that he edited and in many cases translated. I believe there are four volumes, maybe five. I have them all, but I don't know whether there are four or five. I'm trying to visualize that. The Eranos Yearbooks. And so that is where the first English translation appeared. Finally, it was also published, as someone asked me, is it in the collected writings? Yes, it is, in volume 9-1 under the somewhat misleading title The Phenomenology of the Spirit in Fairy Tales. So that's why you didn't find it. It runs from page 207 to page 254 there, or from paragraph 381 to paragraph 455. You know, that's for our scholarly people who want to look it up and want to see whether I have been pulling their leg or not. Now, considering the chronology of the original publication, we need to keep in mind that this was a time, 1945, right at the end of the war, of World War II, when Jung wanted to bring, apparently, the reality and some description of the functioning of the non-material component of the human being to the attention of the culture. As time goes on now, and especially since a few years ago the publication of Jung's Red Book, we can see a much greater underlying motivational continuity between some of Jung's works than we have seen before. So now we often have an idea as to why he brought forth a particular set of teachings, why he brought and called attention to some particular aspect of the psycho-spiritual reality at a particular time. And those considerations usually illuminate the subject and make a certain amount of sense. We need to keep in mind that, as recounted in Aniela Jaffe's Memories, Dreams and Reflections, Jung underwent a great transformation, probably really sort of the last major transformation of his own psyche, the culmination of his experiences in 1944, so only a year before this particular lecture was delivered, and that was the time when, as the result of a very dangerous and potentially fatal illness, he went through a long period of being ill, and at a certain point, as he was coming really out, I mean, he had a heart attack in connection of the illness also, because of a blood clot that originated in a broken ankle, all that sort of thing. And then, you know, a tremendous internal transformational experience came upon him, which, as he himself stated to Aniela Jaffe, not in those words, but which gave him the motivation, as colloquially we would say nowadays, gave him permission to come forth with teachings that he previously was reluctant to reveal. And I won't go into that again. I have done that on other occasions, that when you look at his writings after that date, after all, he still had about 20 years until he passed away, you see that they contain teachings and they have an openness, a courageous disclosure of material that did not really exist in the earlier works. So at that time, when he had these great initiatory experiences, as they may be called, and you can find them in the Memories, Dreams and Reflections, there is a portion toward the end that has to do with visions, and there you find them along with the date. This is what really convinced him that now he could write quite freely about certain matters that previously he felt had to be treated gingerly, had to be somewhat disguised. So this lecture at Ascona in the beautiful Villa Eranos, the first session, I think, since the terrible events of the war had receded, in this lecture he sort of made the first step into that more open and frank period of disclosures which started at that time. And that's one of the reasons why it is, I think, of very great importance. During his illness, he really spent so much time outside of his body, you might say, that he was now once again reassured that what colloquially is called spirit, in German Geist, which is the same as the English ghost. And, you know, those terms remain somewhat interchangeable even in English, because you may recall that in the older religious literature, for instance, the Holy Ghost is mentioned quite often. So the ghost, the Geist, is the Germanic word. But it has a much wider application, in my view, in German than it does really in English. So that he wanted to call attention to this, that is where one needed to look. So, let's say, he was intent on communicating the reality of the non-material aspect, the non-material part of the human being. Materialism was powerful in the culture in Jung's day, and it's not exactly absent in ours. You know, somehow, from time to time, we receive a kind of impulse, a kind of a revelation, an upsurge of interest in what, again in a general sense, non-specific sense, would be called the spirit, the spiritual part of life and of the human being. And then as time goes on, people come in, of course, mostly from the universities and other dreadful places of the culture, and then start chipping away at it. So that you wait a few decades and the spiritual impulse, the spiritual vision that has appeared in the culture, although perhaps it never was fully accepted, but just appeared, is now diminished so that you can hardly discern it. And this was true earlier. You could make a whole historical study of this going back a long ways, but just more or less within our view, in the latter part of the 19th century, sort of beginning with the last quarter of the 19th century, there was a big spiritual revival in the culture. And that lasted into the early and middle part of the 20th century, and there people started chipping away at it. So that by the time we came to the half and the latter half of the 20th century, materialism was once again very strong and prevailing. And this is something that occurred in more recent times also. I think it would be difficult to deny, no matter how critical someone may be of the phenomenon of the 1960s, for instance, that there was no noticeable psycho-spiritual revival taking place at the culture at that time. That many things perhaps went along with it goes without saying. We live in a silly world. What do you expect? But there definitely was, a great, great energy in that regard. And by now, it has been at least in certain influential normative circles of the culture, it has been made to wane and to almost vanish again. So that is how these things seem to happen about in 100-year cycles. Well, Jung obviously saw that taking place in the 1940s, and he felt that as much as his influence and his position permitted, something needed to be done about that. And it would seem that the first salvo, so to say, that he fired at materialism and at a kind of reductionistic and materialistic spirit in psychology, in depth psychology itself, was this talk, this lecture that he gave in Ascona. And there were others given in the same year which sort of tie in with this, and I'm going to mention one particularly, because I'm sure that Jung gave at least one, sometimes two lectures at each one of these sessions. And he was quite aware of what the other people are going to speak about. And he undoubtedly influenced some of the others to speak on topics that he felt were compatible with his own presentation at that time, and with what he felt was a necessary keynote for the culture. So we have once again come to the point where innumerable people in the profession, especially of medical psychology, of psychiatry, look upon the psyche, if they even use that term, look upon it as an epiphenomenon of the brain and of the nervous system. Our brain sort of churns out a psyche. It's a kind of a little machine that makes a psyche. And that's the better opinion. The worst one, of course, is the one that denies a reality to anything outside of the physical in the first place. So Jung was well aware of the at least the partial vagueness of the term spirit when he was speaking about it in this context. And as I say, it's probably even more, the term Geist in German is, I think, even more sort of widespread and diluted in the language than is spirit in English. For instance, just as a little example of it, in German we speak of Geisteswissenschaft, which literally means spiritual science. But what is meant by it officially are the liberal arts, originally proclaimed by Plato, that are still with us. So literature, music, all of these things, I'm not going to go through all seven of them. They are known in German as belonging to the Geisteswissenschaften. So they are spiritual sciences. The others are physical sciences. So it's not a very precise term as such. But it would seem that when it came to this time, Jung felt that there was a need to revive the use and the understanding of spirit in the culture. Perhaps even above the Greek word psyche, which of course is the Greek term for soul. So here is what he wrote quite early in his essay on the psychology of the spirit. The word spirit possesses such a wide range of application that it requires considerable effort to make clear to oneself all the things it can mean. Spirit, we say, is the principle that stands in opposition to matter. By this we understand an immaterial substance or form of existence, which on the highest and most universal level is called God, the highest level. We imagine this immaterial substance also as the vehicle of psychic phenomena or even of life itself. In contradiction to this view, there stands the antithesis. Here the concept of spirit is restricted to the supernatural, and this would be the way that religion was treating the term spirit, supernatural and anti-natural, and has lost its substantial connection with psyche and life. So what he's really telling us here is that both in the religious and in the secular sphere, the meaning of the spirit has been somehow lost. And the way people were using the term no longer carried the kind of open-ended meaning that Jung wished it to carry. He indicates that archaic humanity, and I use the word archaic because along with some others, and those who know me know that I am anything but politically correct. I am Mr. Political Non-Correctness embodied. And I cultivate my non-correctness. I nourish it gently and lovingly within myself. But still, I am not fond of the term primitive in describing ancient peoples, whether of many centuries ago or whether the people with ancient and traditional ways today. So Jung indicates that archaic humanity is aware of what he calls the autonomous and sovereign quality of the entity spirit. And archaic man experiences it as an immaterial breath-like presence which exists in his environment as it were outside of him. And here are some more of Jung's words from the essay. With growing development, however, it enters the sphere of human consciousness and becomes a function under consciousness whereby its autonomous character is apparently lost. Now, this is true of a lot of ways in which we deal with reality. We first project it. That's the easiest way in which we relate to psychic content, let us say, and to spiritual things. We project them, because then we can deal with them as a reality, as an entity outside of ourselves, having a major measure of at least quasi-objectivity. But then, just like he indicates here in a historical context, within our own situation and our own lives, eventually the projections have to be taken back into ourselves. They are reabsorbed. And then gradually we begin to recognize that the reality which we have previously assumed to be out there is not really out there, but that is really somehow mysteriously in here. And then we have to deal with that. It's a general principle, you know. It's even true, and Jung certainly expresses it with great glee in some of his alchemical writings, in the psychology of the transference, that the phenomenon of, quote, falling in love is very much of that nature also. We project all of that energy and internal content and, how should we put it, the realities that we love, we project them out onto somebody. And if we're lucky, then the other person is capable of carrying that projection, and we have a good relationship. And by doing that, we also nourish the same lovely qualities increasingly within ourselves. That's, I don't know whether that's why, but I would say that is certainly something that is involved in the phenomenon which you may have observed, that couples who have been together for a long, long time, they begin to resemble each other, even physically. And that physical resemblance is a manifestation, I think, of the projection and withdrawal of projection game that goes on when we are interacting in a creative manner with somebody. So this is a very universal principle that applies to all kinds of things. Oh no, oh no. All right. We need not look at all kinds of other examples, but he perceives it within this context of how people relate to, well, the spirit. First it's out there, and of course it's generally prevalent in archaic humanity. They're always in the midst of spiritual things. But then, as he says, that autonomous character is apparently lost. The autonomous character is preserved only by the conservative standpoint of the religions. Remember, the angels are out there, God is out there, saints are out there, so forth. The descent of the spirit into the sphere of human consciousness is expressed in the myth of the divine nous, the Greek word nous, being imprisoned in physis, which is physicality in matter. The nous is imprisoned in matter. This process is an inevitable necessity which the religions could not hold up even if they tried. The principle of embodiment, of incarnation, not of Jesus in this instance, but of spirit in the world, is so powerful. Their actual task, however, is not to stop the development, but to form and canalize it in such a way that it can take place without fatal damage to the soul. Therefore, the religions should always remind people of the source and the original character of the spirit, so that man never forgets what he draws into his sphere and with what he fills his consciousness. He has, after all, not created it himself. On the contrary, it is what makes him create. Interesting statement. I thought when I read this first, he means that is what created him. But he says what makes him create. So that our creativity is the result of this quality that is around us and inside of us that is called spirit. Very, very great statement. And so it penetrates the human essence. It so penetrates the human essence that man is severely tempted to believe at certain point that he is the creator of the spirit and that he possesses it. So that is now again when the enantiodromia, so to say, goes the other way, and this is the egotistical danger, the egotistical peril that I spoke about last time. And that I think is worth speaking about a great deal, that at a certain point the danger exists where we begin to arrogate the qualities of this universal force, of this universal reality, and attribute them to our ego. This is what Ernest Wood, one of my dear teachers of years ago, was wont to call the doctrine of the bloated ego. And I think we mentioned last time that maybe we ought to start a campaign now against ego obesity. Ego obesity. Because that's the great danger that is always there. So Jung then reviews the historical transformations and manifestations which the reality of spirit has given rise to in the perception of humanity. He says that two great oversimplification of the view of spirit have occurred. The first we have alluded to just a little while ago, the archaic sort of shamanistic view of spirit as an all-pervading one substance underlying various phenomena, and this then was turned into a materialistic doctrine wherein, as Jung puts it, the identity of spirit and the psyche functions is regarded as depending on the brain. So he anticipates some of the brainomania of recent decades, you know. We noted that this view is still with us. The term spiritual materialism, coined by the late Tibetan teacher Chögyam Trungpa, is perhaps appropriate here. We take things that ought to be really regarded as being of that other reality, which here for probably really lack for a better word, Jung calls the spirit, and we turn them into something material. Needless to say, Jung is opposed to this materialistic hypothesis, which is regarded as definitive by a materialistic culture. Conversely, Jung is not very satisfied with what religion has done with spirit. In the main, the spirit is identified with God, the summum bonum, which is really an alchemical term that he uses here, the supreme good, although the figure of the devil makes its appearance also. As he puts it, the original identity of substance is still expressed in the idea of the fallen angel as well as in the near relationship between Yahweh and Satan. We might add that this is manifested, interestingly enough, in some very old doctrines, very old views of reality, as in Jewish theology, where the tendencies, that's how it is translated. My Hebrew is not very good. I pride myself that I still know my Latin. I know a little bit of Greek, but when it comes to the Hebrew, I have to go to the dictionary. But it's called the Yesirim, and they are translated as proclivities or tendencies. And in the rabbinical theology, it is admitted, I suppose I should say, that the Lord God has both good and bad tendencies, or yesirim. They had to come up with something of that sort, because otherwise, how can you explain the really not very nice and not very acceptable activities of God in the Old Testament, you know? So he has both good and bad tendencies. And then, of course, as time progresses, these tendencies were also split off into a Satan or an evil one, which is still spirit. You know, I mean, the demonic, in the way that term is used in later times, and the divine are both part of that realm that is referred to as spirit. Now, Jung goes on. But these views, the secular as well as the Christian, as have evolved from human consciousness. They have given rise to a confusing variety of definitions of the term spirit, ranging from the dynamic principle of life in classical opposition to matter, the static and inert principle, death, to the spirits of the dead and the volatile substances of alcohol and other stimulating essences. Has it ever occurred to you that a synonym for alcohol is spirit? Of course it is. And which I think is one very good reason why this kind of puritanical nonsense of not having wine for communion and things of that sort should be abominated. And it's a terrible idea that a liquid that even linguistically admits that it has a spirit in it, should be considered something evil. Now, of course, you can have too much spirit, I'm sure. In fact, Jung says later on in the essay, also referring back really to some ancient sources, particularly to Philo of Alexandria, that, yeah, when the daimonion, the spirits, take over in a person at a time when the person is not able to deal with it, they cause insanity and so forth. So certainly too much spirit can make you gaga. And that's also true of too much alcohol. But it's probably true of many, many things. In any event, he brings that in, which I think is a very good thing to mention. Meaning other stimulating essences in addition to alcohol. But they have not considered the fact that the spirit is, now he uses the Greek word, a daimonion. An immediate psychic phenomenon of a morally ambivalent nature, which, thanks to its original autonomy, is perfectly capable of revealing itself. So what he is dancing around here is that while these realities and these energies dwell within us, dwell within our psyche, they have an innate tendency for autonomy. They can act independently of our volition. They can act independently of our ratiocination, our reasoning, because they are autonomous. The term autonomous complex, after all, was coined by Jung quite early in his career, in part in order to explain things of this sort. You see, we delude ourselves into a notion that we are really masters in our house, but the house in this case being our body and mind. We think that we are the top cat at home, you know, but we're really not. We think so, but things happen all the time. Projections and autonomous manifestations of our psyche that we have no real control over. And that bothers us. Because the human being, just by being born into this world, has an innate tendency to become a control freak, as we call it now. You know? We all are control freaks, but of various degrees. When it becomes very powerful, then you're really dealing with a pathology, or somebody who wants to control everything. But to a lesser degree, it's also present in all of us. And that is a serious problem. So he goes on saying, when he speaks of the daimonion, that these spiritual forces within us have a capacity of autonomy. And of course, you know, the Greeks certainly believed that, and Jung is of the view, again, agreeing with Philo and some others, that the daimonion of Socrates, that they were always referring to, that Socrates had a spirit, and that he would ask his daimonion what to do, what not to do. The daimonion would advise him, and the daimonion finally advised him that it was all right for him to take the hemlock to die. And people tried to figure out what that was, but Jung says, again, agreeing with some of the more mystical interpreters of the ancients, that the daimonion of Socrates was his own higher self, autonomous, to the point that it could converse with him. And that is certainly a strong possibility. The self-revelation of the spirit, which is not dependent on our ordinary volition, and philosophizing occurs, for instance, it's not dependent on our arbitrary vision and philosophizing. It does its own thing. And it reveals itself, as he mentions here, in two readily accessible modalities, and these are first the dream and secondly, the fairy tale. I'm not going to deal a lot with the fairy tales which Jung writes about in this essay, because they just really repeat in many ways the principle that also appears in dreams and in altered states of consciousness. So, in dreams, he says, the factor of spirit may appear as a special kind of father complex. Certain actions, decisive convictions, impulses, advice or prohibitions arise from the image of the internal father figure, mostly an old man, magician, doctor, priest, teacher, or any other person of authority. Of course, what he's speaking of is here, which later on went into the, the language of Jungian archetypes as the wise old man. Not to be confused, as I like to point out, with the old wise guy. That's the archetype that I increasingly feel I am embodying. So the wise old man. Less frequently we find grotesque, gnome-like figures, dwarves or talking animals. At times a boy or youth represents the spirit. And here are some direct quotations from Jung here. In any form, the archetype of the spirit appears in situations where insight, understanding, plans, decisions would be necessary, but cannot be produced by one's own means. Another way of stating that would be when the resources of our ego are inadequate to deal with some life situation, internal or external, or probably the combination of both. Then the wise old man archetype, the archetype of wisdom, comes and helps us out. I'm particularly fascinated by this, and I don't expect you to share my fascination necessarily, because just within the last few weeks, I noticed this kind of a development in my own dreams, wherein, and I don't want to regale you here with my own weirdnesses, but let me just say, one dream, the first dream, is sort of going to meet the wise old man, which was within the setting of a monastery out in the woods. And I don't like the woods, and I don't like to dream about woods. You know, I am not a tree hugger. And it may have occurred to you that some years ago, most of the tree huggers were also bush bashers. Just a little, just a little play on words. Words are very interesting. So in the first dream, there's the whole elaborate situation, a very beautiful one, wherein obviously I and some others with me went to see the wise man. But the wise man wasn't home. And so we were told that was the case, and that should come back another time. And all kinds of very beautiful and magical things connected with it. Very, very, very nice dream, very entertaining. And then, not very long after that, there comes, within a different setting of dream imagery, comes a journey to in this case, to another country, to Paris, actually. I mean, if you're going to go look for the wise man, you might as well go to a nice place like Paris, rather than into the woods. And in the usual sort of almost labyrinthine way, wherein the one guide takes you somewhere and to another one, and then finally, in a very dramatic way, the meeting with the wise man occurs. And as that often happens, at least to me, when you're then confronted and looking the wise man straight into the face, there is a big blaze of light and the dream is over. Or at least you don't remember anymore. And my interpretation of that is that then you reach a level of consciousness which is far more difficult to translate into your ordinary terms, and therefore you can't translate it, and it cuts off at that particular point. But these are some, that is definitely one of the very important figures that, how should I put it, and what he's talking about here, that who is the representative and the embodiment of the spirit to you, the ego. And here he writes about the boy: in any form, the archetype of the spirit appears in situations, as I mentioned, where insight and understanding and so. It is never 100% certain whether the spirit figures in dreams are morally good. Often they appear not only ambivalent, but downright malicious. Who knows about the great plan and how much evil is necessary to bring about a good by enantiodromia, and which good will tempt one into evil? Wait and see. Here he engages in a kind of little sideline of philosophizing, which I would say is probably not without some relevance to the fact that the great and terrible war just ended when he was giving this speech. You know, all this evil was about, who knows how much of this is necessary until things can turn, that is the enantiodromia, to the good. When you hit the ground level, then there is no other way but up. And when will that happen? So he sort of muses on that. So what we need to keep in mind, and which is very important, is that as he expresses quite eloquently in this essay, that on the way to real, profound, original, spiritual or religious experience, the human being is not simply presented with the desired, ready-made solutions, but is, as Jung says, and I quote him now, confronted with the problem of the uncertainty of moral valuation, with the confusing interplay of good and bad, and the inexorable concatenation of guilt, suffering, and redemption. This way is right, but how many can recognize it? It is a low voice sounding from a distance. It is ambiguous, doubtful, and dark, and sometimes means danger and risk. An uncertain path which one can only take for the sake or by the will of God, without security and without sanction. Now, what does this mean for our purpose? It sounds paradoxical. I think mainly it means that the experiences of the non-physical world are really different. They are. We already can see that in dreams and even more in the visionary reality. They involve very often ambivalent experiences wherein light and dark are interacting in weird ways. Now, if anyone was familiar with that, it was C.G. Jung. For it was in such a manner that the great transformational experiences of much, if not all, of the Red Book came to him. Once again, we may need to remember that what we are engaged in our interaction with what is here called the spirit, is not a series of episodes, but it is a process. And this is the process which in the Red Book Jung divided into three: war, magic, and religion. Meaning there is conflict between right and left, between the morally acceptable and the morally not acceptable, and various other things. Then the magical period of transformation, the magical change, and then a move into the much closer and direct relationship with the ultimate source of the psyche, which is the God within. So the psychological or even psycho-spiritual transformation of the psyche is not identical with the proverbial enlightenment, which of course involves a contact with light and more light, which brings to my mind the comparatively recent incident where a dear gentleman who was here from a far country visiting, who came this time now for the second year in a row to my lectures in Ojai, California, was visiting some of my friends there of the Theosophical Society, and he became sort of fed up with what he considered to be the one-sidedness of the psyches and the orientation of the people there. And he remonstrated with somebody saying, there's too much light here, there's too much light here. He says, how about some darkness? Where is the darkness? You need the light and the darkness. And of course they said, oh no, we like the light, we want the light. But the good man, being a good Jungian, you know, realizes that in order for the alchemy to take place, there has to be an interaction of the opposites. And then Jung goes on from the consideration of these transformational symbols, Jung proceeds to the symbolism of fairy tales. And here he says, I quote this much, in fairy tales the same variety of motif spirit can be observed as in dreams, without consideration of individual situations. Because, of course, the fairy story is for many people, it's not just one person's story. The old man appears just as frequently whenever the hero finds himself in a hopeless and desperate fix. He represents, or rather embodies, the concentration of moral, and these are Jung's words, the concentration of moral and physical energies and of reflections which take place in the psychical sphere outside of conscious awareness when conscious thinking is not yet or no longer possible. His intervention means a spontaneous objectivation of the archetype which quietens and stops the merely effective reactions of a chain of inner processes of confrontations and realizations. So the archetype becomes active, becomes more objectified. It becomes increasingly evident in the course of his essay that Jung is trying to show us that in two fairly frequent manifestations, namely in dreams and in fairy tales, the deep powers of the unconscious are manifesting. He then interprets in great detail some fairy tales, indicating that they originate in altered states of consciousness. He doesn't use that word, but it's quite obvious. One of the principal conclusions of his essay is, in fact, these are my words now, that the truly informative and transformative experience of what he calls here the spirit are received in ecstatic or altered states of consciousness. It's not really that difficult a proposition. I would say a sort of paradigm of it is, there are many, but that can indicate to you a little bit as to how this works, is the Zen koan. You know, in Zen Buddhism there is a particular technique where the disciple is confronted with a logical impossibility. You know, like the goose is in the bottle. How is the goose going to come out of the bottle when you cannot break the bottle and you don't want to injure the goose? And of course the answer is that there is no answer. You know, it can't be done. And the desired result from these curious stories is that straining to find a solution, the psyche, the mind, shifts gears and goes to another kind of reality, to another kind of consciousness, and the answer is Yes, the goose is out of the bottle. Now, I hope that there is a little involvement, maybe with a little good foie gras here, because I think that it's very contrary to my Zen Buddhist sensibilities that they are outlawing the sale of goose liver, you know. But that's just a little diversion into a culinary reality. So, there has to be a jump out of the ordinary rational consciousness. And when that jump occurs, then all of a sudden everything is all right. Maybe the problem is solved, maybe it's been recognized there is no problem. But in any event, something very wonderful and something very powerful has happened. You know? Of course, there was a lecture by the late Sufi writer and teacher Idris Shah, who said that, you know, that on other Zen koanies you have heard the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand clapping? He said, listen close. You can't hear it too well, but it's there. There is a sound of one hand clapping. But that's just a nice little joke, I think. In any event, this is the sort of thing that you can't just spin your wheels on one level of consciousness where logic and rationality and causality and morality and whatever the it is may be in addition to that rules. But there has to be a way at a certain point to be able to rise out of that and then come to certain insights and recognitions which don't really belong into that world, but which are, when one has come to them, capable of infusing the ordinary world with a great deal more meaning, a great deal more good sense, and various other good qualities, you know. At this point, it may be useful to keep in mind that Jung stated repeatedly that he had a very high regard for a particular philosopher of late antiquity, a contemporary of our Gnostic friends like Valentinus and Basilides and people like that, named Philo or Philo of Alexandria, who was, I would call him an esoteric Jew, in many respects a follower of Plato, and who was the first one to use the term archetype. Jung said that he got the term archetype from Philo. Plato echoed in certain respects, Plato was in certain respects the first one to express a concept of archetype, but not the word itself. And especially when it came to the means whereby the mysterious regions of the inner world, now mostly called the unconscious, are entered. Plato showed the way, and of course Philo was a great follower of Plato. And Plato himself spoke, and I will not elaborate on this much, of four kinds of altered states of consciousness, and he attributed a particular god, a particular deity of the Greek pantheon to each. One of these was the state of oracle, wherein a person becomes entranced and utters messages that otherwise are not available to the person, gaining information, so to say, from ecstatic sources. And this, Plato said, is presided over by Apollo. Apollo, who is really the god of inspiration. The second is, as is called, telestic or ritual ecstasy, wherein various activities and rites are engaged in, and the objective is not information, but the altering of one's self. So you might say this is a transformational ritual, and this, Plato said, presided over by Dionysus. The third one, who is a very strange fellow indeed, Dionysus, you know, and he's a good example of this moral ambivalence, this enantiodromic quality of many archetypes in the unconscious. The third one is ecstatic possession by the muses. The muses preside over this one. Inspiration primarily in the form of speech, although other means may be included also. And this has to do with the inspiration that is channeled into what today we would call various forms of artistic expression. And the fourth one is erotic ecstasy, which is inspired by, wouldn't you know, Aphrodite in her see-through Grecian nightie, and her compadre Eros. So this is erotic mysticism, which mostly has its effects on the psyche, and Joseph Campbell certainly felt that the mythos and the activities of the troubadours were of this order. So coming back now to Philo, the Platonist, it is noteworthy that at the same Eranos conference in 1945, where Jung delivered his lecture on the psychology of the spirit, his friend Max Pulver, the Swiss expert on Gnosticism, who was also a world-renowned handwriting expert, graphologist, Max Pulver, great Gnostic scholar. Max Pulver also gave a lecture, and the lecture was on Philo of Alexandria and of the experience of Philo's experience of the pneuma, the spirit, as it is called in Greek. So Jung had undoubtedly read Pulver's essay and saw his contribution, and that of his friend and countryman Pulver complemented each other. Pulver held, no doubt on the basis of Gnostic teachings, that the spirit and the divine spirit resided in the human being. Being a believing Jew, old Philo replaced the Platonic concept of daimon with that of angel. The angel who inhabits the human is of a special variety, said Philo of Alexandria, a divine angel. And it's quite evident that it is the personification, the angelization of the nous joined to the pneuma, that is, the nous joined to the ultimate spirit. But it is an individualized God inside the human. So Pulver points out the great affinity of Philo's idea of the human spirit to that of the Christian Gnostics. Pulver says of Philo that Philo saw a connection between the pneuma, the spirit, and such experiences which he himself was the partaker of, as ecstasy, revelation, prophecy, divination by dreams. Pulver quotes Philo as stating that four types of ecstasy were the ones that he contacted, somewhat similar, although also different from the four enumerated by Plato. The first that Philo mentions is pathological. So here I think he would have joined some modern psychiatrists and things like that. Because Philo says that ecstasy is a mad fury producing mental delusion owing to some defect in the individual, such as senility or melancholy or other similar cause. So that when an unstable psyche is taken over by the state of ecstasy, it can become dicey, it can become pathological. Really crazy people hardly make good prophets. They think that they are. And sometimes other people are stupid enough to think so too. But it is not as it is. So this is part of proving your spirits. And I think that there were a few people in fairly recent memory in the political field who qualify under that, such as, for instance, a certain individual with a curious misshapen mustache under his nose, whom you may recognize. You know, here's somebody who is really out there. where there is a serious pathology, yet there was inspiration, there was power, there was ecstasy. All you have to see or hear is one of Hitler's speeches and the reaction of people to it. You can tell that some kind of a very, very powerful, albeit malign, phenomenon of a psychic nature is taking place there. But that's only one, that's the lowest kind. The second, said Philo, is extreme amazement when someone experiences some event very unexpectedly that causes an altered state. Now, the only thought that comes to me is that in some mystery procedures, in some of the mystery rituals, the initiate is confronted with strange and unexpected things, strange and unexpected events. All of a sudden a dagger to your chest and things like that, which may be familiar to some, you know. And that really in the mysteries of antiquity, these activities were meant to cause a change of consciousness, an altering of consciousness. So he mentions that. The third one, he says, becomes a passivity of mind. If the mind indeed can be ever at rest. And Philo's statement is, the sleep of the senses is the awakening of the spirit. So when the senses and the constant jabberwocky of the lower mind is quieted down, is put out of the way, then the deeper perception may awaken. And the fourth, which certainly Philo considers the best form of all, is the divine possession, entheos, to which the prophets as a class are subject. Fortunately, in this nice volume edited by Joseph Campbell and the Eranos books, Eranos e-books number 1, there is not only Jung's great essay, but also Max Pulver's essay about Philo. And here, when Pulver concludes his lecture, his essay, he gives a direct quotation from Philo. Philo speaks about himself. And Philo says, I feel no shame in recording my own experience. A thing I know from its having happened to me 1,000 times. Oh, well, that's quite a lot, if it's not just a figure. On some occasions, after making up my mind to follow the usual course of writing on deeper philosophical tenets, and knowing definitely the substance of what I was to set down, I have found my understanding incapable of giving birth to a single idea, and have given it up without accomplishing anything, reviling my understanding for its self-conceit, and filled with amazement at the might of him that is to whom is due the opening and closing of the soul wombs. Well, this is, you know, flowery Greek speech. But what he says is that in so many of those cases where he had it all figured out, what he is going to write about and how, and this is going to be great, and that's it, and he went blank. Nothing happened, you know. And the reason he really implies for it is because he wasn't really tuned in to the right kind of transcendental consciousness. He was working purely on an ego level, and there what he wanted to accomplish could not really be accomplished. But, fortunately, on the other occasions, I have approached my work empty and suddenly became full, the ideas falling in a shower from above and being sown invisibly, so that under the influence of the divine possession, I have been filled with corybantic frenzy. The corybantes were the dancers of Dionysius. Corybantic frenzy, and been unconscious of anything, place, persons present, myself, words spoken, lines written. For I obtained language, ideas, an enjoyment of keenest vision, of pellucid, distinctness of objects such as might be received through the eyes as the result of clearest showing. So he contrasts here the inspired activity, the inspired writing, and the one which was anything but inspired. So ecstasy means, you know, standing outside of oneself, ecstasis. But of course, this is not easy. No matter what historical period we live in, no matter what influences we have been subjected to, somehow that ego is always there. I want to have something. I want to be. I want this. I want that. As J.R.R. Tolkien, another great inspired prophetic figure, put it, the greed of self-centered power, which is the mark of the mere lower magician. This is kind of the Saruman type, you know. Greed of self-centered power. We cannot penetrate into a new reality or create a new reality if we do not experience a shift of gears, an altering of the powers of the mind. An unaltered mind can only reshuffle the pieces of the old world. And that's sort of what Philo says there, you know, he couldn't do anything, because what he really wanted to do couldn't be accomplished by those means. Another technological piece here, another political piece there, another improvement on the new little god, the cell phone, you know. But in the last analysis, it is really the same old balderdash reshuffled. The chessboard is the same, the chess figures are the same, only the arrangement is new. Now just think about that a little bit, that how often we do that. How often we do that. The artist, the mystic, the Gnostic, the alchemist sees through this dreary deception that masquerades as something new but isn't. And then there is always the ethical dilemma that Jung alludes to. False creation, creation without inspiration, without ecstasy, cannot give without taking away. The false creativity is a danger. Why? Because the consensus reality is made that way. When you take power, chances are you are taking power from somewhere or somebody where it might belong. You have to be very conscious, very perceptive, and very compassionate when you create your reality in this world, if you want to use that term. Because your reality is always entwined with other realities and with the realities of others. So you've got to be careful. When you ecstatically step out of this world, however, and creatively enter another, whether it's called, I don't know, with the South American native people, a Nagual, or an Elfland with Tolkien, or a Pleroma, or a higher Aeon, then the ethical problem is not present. Why is that? Because the fullness is full. There you don't take anything away from anyone. Yeah? You don't shortchange anything or anybody when you draw from the right source. But what in Greek is called the kenoma, the emptiness, which is the personal world, it is that way. We got only so much here. Somewhere else there is plenty. So we must be careful not to confuse the two. Abundance exists in the higher worlds. Abundance exists in what Jung in this essay calls the spirit. But here we must work with available resources, and the two should not be confused. Since we mentioned J.R.R. Tolkien a few minutes ago, it may be significant to recall that Tolkien always insisted that his work was fairy story. In fact, he wrote a fabulous little work, which is sort of the really the rationale of his writing on the fairy story. Jung devoted a considerable portion of this essay, The Psychology of the Spirit, to the fairy tale, in which he perceives the activity of the archetypal psyche. The fairy story originates in exalted or altered consciousness. To appreciate it, says Jung, one has to be affinitized to the same kind of consciousness. And just because of some event that occurred this week, I think I might also interject a word about our late and great fellow Californian and Angeleno, Mr. Ray Bradbury, God rest his soul. And Mr. Bradbury frequently insisted that it was a misnomer to call him a science fiction writer. He was not a science fiction writer, he was a fantasy fiction writer. And this is a little bit like the fairy story. What Tolkien called the fairy story and what Jung calls the fairy tale expresses emblematically something that is of a different reality. Science fiction, with its technological emphasis, hasn't really divorced itself from, even though it might be up on Jupiter or something, has not really divorced itself from the terrestrial consensus reality. So I think that in Mr. Bradbury we had someone very much of this kind, and we should be grateful that he was among us for so long. As to Jung, here is what he wrote. It seems to me, this is toward the end of his essay that we are dealing with, it seems to me, frankly, that former ages did not exaggerate, that the spirit has not sloughed off its demonisms, which means that the daimonion, the autonomy of the spirit inside, like the daimonion of Socrates, that this is still here, and that mankind, because of its scientific and technological development, has in increasing measure delivered itself over to the danger of possession. By which he means that when we don't pay attention to the daimonion, when we don't have a creative, inspired interaction with the deeper psyche, with the wise old man, perhaps, you know, with the self itself, then these powers can possess us. They take over the ego, they take over the personality without our permission. And we may have some experiences of one kind or the other, we may do some things that of one kind or the other, and afterwards we say the famous words, I don't know what came over me. I don't know what came over me, or maybe who came over me. Yes, yes, it does happen. True, the archetype of the spirit is capable of working for good as well as for bad, as Jung points out. But it depends upon the free, that is, conscious decision of the human, whether the good also will be perverted into something bad. The human's worst sin is unconsciousness. These are Jung's own words now. But it is indulged in with the greatest piety even by those who serve mankind as teachers and examples. A lot of unconscious teachers and examples. When shall we stop taking the human for granted in this barbarous manner and in all seriousness seek ways and means to exorcise him, to rescue him from possession and unconsciousness, and make this the most vital task of civilization? Question mark. Can we not understand that all the outward tinkerings and improvements do not touch man's inner nature, and that ultimately depends upon whether the man who wields the science and the techniques is capable of responsibility or not. Question. And this is in the essay in the latter part. We need to add, becoming conscious of the spirit within us and not allowing it to be obscured by tinkering and improvements, as he says, which indeed do not touch our inner nature. This is a very important task. And here I have a lovely little quotation which comes from another writing of Jung, but in which I think all of this is summed up in a most magnificent way. Here is what Jung said. The main interest of my work is not the treatment of neurosis, but the approach to the numinous, which is the real therapy. Numinous is, you know, is a word derived from numen, which is a Roman, a Latin word for a god, although a certain kind of a god, because this is, the numens were kind of the gods of the Etruscans. They are much more magical and weirder deities than the later Roman gods, with nice statues, you know, and then the emperors and the empresses also, you know, they became gods and then they built them a statue and so. So the whole business of the gods kind of really became rather muddled, but the noumen, that's something that comes out of the dark, and that is the numinous. So it is the numinous which is the real therapy. Why? Because, as he said before, here the worst sin, and we might substitute for sin the worst neurosis, the worst illness, is unconsciousness. And so when that which alone makes conscious comes forth from our inner recesses and takes over, when we become in that fashion entheos, filled with the God, that is the real therapy, because the great illness is then cured. And all the little illnesses, all the little sicknesses, all the little psychoses and psychoneuroses and so forth, they're all connected to that one basic great illness, that we are not in touch with that which is real, with that which is alone truly helpful, and which is the great healer. You know, Jung, with his German language background, obviously was conscious of this, but I think there is no other language on the face of the earth that has the same root word for the following meanings: to heal, which is Heilen, the Savior, which is Heiland, and Heilig, which is holy. In other languages, there are similar, Salus and Salvator, for instance, in Latin, are the same. But this is the healer, the Savior, the holiness, the Holy One. Where does it live? Well, at one time, we thought it was out there. But the time comes, as Jung puts in this essay, when increasingly recognized that it is within. That doesn't mean that the outer projections and the iconography and so forth are not very useful, because they remind us of what this is really all about. But it is here, and it is the only real, it is the only healer. And we have within us the capacity to come to it, to change the gears of our consciousness, to rise out of the ordinary and the banal and the repetitive and the meaningless and come to its opposite. This essay of Jung's is a difficult one. It was a great challenge for me to work with it, and I hope it wasn't an equally great challenge for you to listen to me about it, because it's not an easy one to deal with. Many of the others are a lot easier. But I think it's a tremendously important issue and a tremendously important emphasis, that indeed what is the most important about us is spirit. And therefore, if we address ourselves to it, we take full advantage of it, we keep relating ourselves to it, we cannot go wrong. and we will be healed of the great illness, of the great sin which is unconsciousness, and we will have become what we were intended to become all along. So I hope this has been of interest to you, and I thank you very much for having me.
Copyright MMX II by BC Recordings. Recording code 912F08. For Dr. Heller's presentations on a wide variety of topics, please visit bcrecordings.net.